Hello, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. Today is the 12th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. I am going to be going over bacterial cases. We'll try to review some high yield information relating to bacteria. This will be the first of many podcasts relating to the bacteria. And I wish everyone studying for step one all the best. Or if you're studying for step two, or if you're a fourth year who is rocking it out right now because you don't have much to do because you're about to start residency, I wish you guys all the best. And if you have any questions or any feedback on the podcasts, feel free to reach out to divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. Again, the email is divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. So let's get right into it. So the first question. A 26-year-old presents to the ED with a two-day history of high fevers and joint pain. He recently completed a tough mother race in Oahu. Physical exam is notable for conjunctival erythema with no purulent drainage discharge. AST, ALT are markedly elevated. Creatinine is 2.5. So, the questions I have. What's the bug? What are its special properties? What are the risk factors and how do you treat this bug? So, the thing is, they generally do not give you names of places on MBME exams for sure. Those country names or state names or city names are almost always related to something that will give you a clue to answering the question. So, in this case, I talk about Oahu, which is in Hawaii. Okay, that's one. Two, I talk about a person going for like a muddy-ish race, where they probably are in contact with like a lot of like dirty water and things like that, okay? So hopefully you're thinking about leptospirosis, okay? Leptospirosis, it's caused by Leptospira interrogans. You know this is a spirochete, so just like Treponema pallidum, it should be visible under dark field microscopy, although that's not very sensitive. And the classic presentation is this bug has an association with exposure to bodies of water that are infected with animal urine. So like rat urine or rodent urine, anything like that. And you definitely want to know the classic presentation, right? So it classically presents with like high fevers, joint pain, and usually the people have conjunctivitis, but it's a non-purulent conjunctivitis. And the thing is, if it's left untreated, it can become very severe and present as something called Wells disease. That's where your liver basically explodes. If you ever hear me say your liver explodes, I just mean you have some kind of hepatitis, okay? So your liver explodes and your kidneys explode as well. That's why the creatinine is elevated. And the way you treat leptospirosis is with penicillin, or you could also use the 30S inhibitor doxycycline. Remember, doxycycline is a kind of tetracycline. Okay, and so the big risk factor is exposure to bodies of water that have been infected with rodent urine. Next question. 23-year-old presents with left jaw pain. He recently had a root canal procedure completed in a foreign country to reduce cost. Physical exam is notable for a lumpy mass just below the left maxilla. Gentle palpation leads to the expression of purulent material. So what's the bug? What are its special properties? What's the classic presentation? How do you treat this issue? And contrast with a closely related cousin, right? So this closely related cousin is a particular bug I'm going after. There are certain sources of this infection. The bug has special properties. I'll talk about how you also treat that close cousin, okay? So this person had a dental procedure, and then they have a mass that's draining purulent material, right? A cervical facial mass. Hopefully you're thinking of Actinomyces israelii. Okay, remember, it's a filamentous gram-positive rat that is anaerobic, right? So it doesn't use oxygen, and it is not acid fast, right? So it doesn't stain positive with the Zeal-Nielsen stain. You can already begin to think that the second part of the question relates to nocardia, okay? So the classic presentation is a person that got some kind of dental procedure done, and then they have some kind of infection where the infection drains sinus tracts, and you see like what they classically call sulfur granules. Those sulfur granules just contain like dead bacteria and a ton of neutrophils. Okay, and the way you treat this bug is you give penicillin. So the close cousin I was referring to here is nocardia. Okay, unlike actinomyces, that's an anaerobe, nocardia is an aerobe. Unlike actinomyces, that is not acid fast, nocardia is in fact weakly acid fast. In fact, it stains positive with a Zeal-Nielsen stain. Okay, and just like actinomyces, nocardia is a filamentous branching gram-positive rods. Okay, gram-positive rod, and the thing is, it classically presents as abscesses in many different organs of the body. And the way you actually treat it is with Bactrim. Okay, Bactrim is the trade name for trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Hopefully you remember that sulfamethoxazole is an inhibitor of dihydropterate synthesis, okay, which is the enzyme that metabolizes PABA to like dihydrofolate. And then trimethoprim is a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor, okay? It prevents the formation of tetrahydrofolate from dihydrofolate. Remember, there are other drugs that work that way, drugs like methotrexate and drugs like pyrimethamine. So just something to keep in mind. Now, just as an aside, just real quick as an aside, what is one high-yield enzyme that's expressed by nocardia, by H. pylori, by Proteus mirabilis, by Europlasma urolyticum, by Klebsiella pneumoniae, and also by Staph epidermidis, if I'm remembering correctly. That's urease, okay? That's urease. So just another added tidbit for you there. And just real quick, if you hear a murmur on auscultation of a person's chest and you recently had a dental procedure, what are you thinking about? I hope you're saying strep viridans, okay? Strep viridans. Okay, so let's jump up to the next question. So a 7-year-old male who recently went on a zoology class trip to a forest in North Carolina presents with a 24-hour history of a temperature to 104, that's super high, severe headache and shortness of breath. Physical exam is notable for a rash on the palms and soles. Ding, 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 ding. His mom mentions that this rash initially started on the ankles and wrists and spread to his trunk. Ding, 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 ding. So what's the bug? How is it transmitted? What are its special properties? And how do you treat this bug? This bug is actually kind of unique in that there are different treatment strategies for different populations of individuals. So we'll talk about that shortly, okay? And then I'll talk about some special wear testing and the CBC electrolyte anomalies you get with this bug. So this is Rickettsia rickettsii, okay? So this is Rocky Mountain spotted fever, right? So hopefully the clue for you was the rash on the palms and soles. Remember the mnemonic you learn as you're studying for step one, that you drive Kawasaki cars with your hands and feet, okay? So like Coxsackie A, Rickettsia rickettsii, and secondary syphilis, and also Kawasaki's disease, all present with a rash on the palms and soles, okay? So this person has Rickettsia rickettsii. That's Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It's a zoonotic infection, right? It's carried by the Dermacenta tick. So that's something you want to know. It's also a gram-negative intracellular bug, okay? And it's actually an obligate intracellular bug. The reasoning behind that is that it cannot make enough ATP for its own use. And it can actually stain positive with Gimsa. It can actually stain positive with Gimsa. Other Gimsa-positive organisms include bugs like Borrelia burgdorferi that causes Lyme disease and chlamydia, okay? Now, you definitely also want to know your geographic association, okay? Not necessarily the Rocky Mountains, but states like North Carolina, Tennessee, Oklahoma. And the rash spreads in a centripetal fashion, right? So it starts on the ankles and wrists. It then goes to the trunk. So it spreads from the outside inwards. And then it spreads back out to the palms and soles, okay? And in general, for every patient that has Rickettsia rickettsii infection, you go ahead and treat with doxycycline, okay? So you've probably heard this thing, which is largely true for most other bugs, but this one specifically. You've largely heard that if kids are less than 8, instead of giving them doxycycline for infections like Lyme disease, for example, you give them amoxicillin. That is true for Lyme disease, but that is absolutely not true for Rickettsia rickettsii, okay? For everyone, including kids that are less than 8 years old, you treat Rickettsia rickettsii with doxycycline, Okay, because usually the kids get the dose for like a very short period of time, so there is a very low risk of them having the tooth discoloration and the stunting of bone growth that you come to expect with the tetracyclines. Okay, but in pregnant women in general, you give chloramphenicol. Hopefully, you remember that chloramphenicol is a 50S peptidotransferase inhibitor. Now, the weird testing that you use for rickettsial species in general is the Weill-Felix test, okay? Basically, you the antibodies that our body makes against Rickettsia rickettsii, for some reason, they agglutinate when they're exposed to antigens from Proteus species. So that's what constitutes the Weill-Felix test. It's just a good test for most of the rickettsial species. One way they can test this in the context of another bug on your exams is with Coxiella bonnerii. Coxiella is, it's sort of related to the rickettsial species, but it's actually Weill-Felix test negative. And in general, with rickettsial infections on exams, they will give you the person having low platelets, so they will have a thrombocytopenia, and their sodium concentration in the blood will also be low, so they classically have a hyponatremia. Okay. As an aside, also remember that hyponatremia is associated with Legionella pneumophila. We'll talk about that in a later later question. Okay, so next question. This is actually multiple choice. So it's a 33-year-old female, presents with a 12-hour history of severe groin pain. Her past medical history is unremarkable, although she recently received cefazolin for an infection, right? So cefazolin is a cephalosporin. The patient is uncooperative during the physical exam due to severe pain. Urinalysis reveals a pH of 7.1. That's really high. Other studies are pending. CBC and CMP are within normal limits. Results of a non-contrast helical CT, that's like the test of choice, diagnostic test of choice for nephrolithiasis. So, results of a non-con helical CT are shown below. What is the most likely cause of this patient's symptoms, right? So, if you look at this x-ray pretty well, you can see that it's clearly Staghorn calculus, right? So, you're thinking of some kind of urease positive bug, and the only one that fits that description here conspicuously is Proteus mirabilis. So, the answer here is D. Okay, so the answer is D. Okay, so again, urine, high pH, imaging, Staghorn calculi, think about a urease positive bug. Okay, so like P. mirabilis, Staph saprophyticus, Klebsiella species. Okay, and in general, if a person ever has like nephrolithiasis, the thing you generally want to do is not to get an x-ray. That would be the wrong answer on exams. Okay, the thing you want to get is a non-contrast helical CT scan. Okay, in general, on x-rays though, an x-ray will generally reveal kidney stones with the exception of uric acid stones, right? Remember, those are radiolucent. Okay, so those cannot be picked up on a chest on an abdominal film. Okay, now there are certain high yield associations you definitely want to keep in mind, right? With kidney stones, right? So the most common kind of kidney stone is a calcium stone. Okay. But the thing is, you will think that everyone that has calcium stones, calcium kidney stones, have high levels of calcium in the blood and high levels of calcium in the urine. That is not true. Okay. In general, these people tend to have normal calcium levels and elevated levels of calcium in the urine. Right. So you may potentially be able to treat these problems with a thiazide diuretic, right? Because remember, thiazides, they help you retain calcium in the urine, but loops actually help you dump calcium in the urine. So you probably don't want to give a loop diuretic to a person that has a history of calcium kidney stones. Staghorn calculi, I've talked about that with the urease positive bugs. Uric acid stones, gout, I've talked about that. If you have any kind of hematologic malignancy, right, where you're overproducing and overkilling lymphoid cells or other myeloid cells. As you kill those cells, they release a lot of DNA into the surroundings, okay? So you can imagine that you can also get a very high uric acid load with that. That can precipitate a nephrolithiasis. That's why you generally give allopurinol or febuxostat, which is xanthine oxidase inhibitors, to people that are getting chemotherapy for the hematologic malignancies. Okay. Now, You can also get disease in the terminal ileum that can cause hyperoxaluria. Okay, and if you have hyperoxaluria, you can get calcium oxalate stones. Okay, if you also try to poison yourself with antifreeze, you can also get calcium oxalate stones. And in general, the way you treat left urethritis is you hydrate the patient, you give them pain control, or for a big one like the Staghorn calculi, you probably need to do some kind of surgery or like super hyperdynamic shockwave lithotripsy. But I'll say in general, for Staghorn calculi, you're going to get a urologist to get that stuff out. There's no way you can really use sound waves to break something like that up. And as an aside, don't forget the bug of the hour, right? P. mirabilis. It's gram negative. It's oxidase negative. Okay. I'll talk about the oxidase test in a later slide. Okay. But it's gram negative. It's an oxidase negative rod. Okay. It does not grow on McConkie's agar. Right. So it's a lactose non-fermenter. And one classic way to describe P. mirabilis in exam questions is it has swarming motility. If you say swarming motility, stop reading the question. It's almost certainly going to be P. mirabilis. Okay, and again, it's urease positive. It can form ammonium magnesium phosphate stones. Okay, those are known as struvite stones or Staghorn calculi. Remember, those are classically coffin lid shaped. Okay, and again, the urine pH is almost always high. Okay, and in general, if you have like bladder infection, right? So cystitis from Proteus mirabilis, you classically treat with Bactrim, right? So trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or ciprofloxacin. Remember, cipro is a fluoroquinolone. Fluoroquinolones work by inhibiting DNA gyrase, also known as topoisomerase. Okay, but if you have like pyelonephritis, you generally want to either give cipro or you want to give ceftriaxone. I'll say in general, on MBME exams, if a person has pyelonephritis, your go-to drug is ceftriaxone. That is the most common answer choice on exams. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. A 10-year-old kid presents with a 3-day history of temperature to 104, severe headache, and shortness of breath. A 4 out of 6 systolic murmur is heard at the apex. He lives on a farm with his parents, where they rear sheep and cattle. Platelet count is 90,000. Okay, so what's the diagnosis? What's the bug? What are its special properties? What kind of diagnostic testing can be done? Are there any other associations? We'll talk about those. And how do you treat this bug? Okay, and then we'll talk about 4 bugs that are carried by the Ixodes tick. And I put a mnemonic there for you, ABEB. I don't know how helpful that is, but we'll talk about that. So this kid plays with cattle and sheep. Okay, and then this kid has very high temperatures, severe headache, shortness of breath, and thrombocytopenia. A normal platelet count is from 150,000 to 400,000. If you see this, I really hope you're thinking about Q fever, okay, from Coxiella bonnerii. Okay, remember, it's an obligate intracellular bug. It actually forms spores. While we're on this topic of spores, right? So remember, your high-yield spore-forming bugs, there's your Clostridium species, there's your Bacillus species, there is Clostridium, Bacillus, Coxiella. There is one more I'm forgetting for some reason. Well, hopefully it will come before the end of the podcast. Okay, so form spores, okay, and the way you actually diagnose C. bonnerii, usually it's diagnosed by clinical history, but you can also do an indirect fluorescent antibody test, okay? Now, some other associations with C. bonnerii, it actually has some unusual things that your friends at the MBME love to test quite often. Okay, so it's actually associated with endocarditis, right? That's why this kid has the 4 out of 6 systolic murmur in the question stem. But the thing is, in general, the blood cultures, right? Because if you suspect endocarditis, you get blood cultures, right? The blood cultures with C. bonnerii endocarditis classically do not grow anything. Okay, so that's an example of a culture negative endocarditis. If you see culture negative endocarditis, besides a Coxiella bonnerii, which is actually one of the most common causes of culture negative endocarditis, you also want to think about your HACCP organisms, right? So bugs like Haemophilus, Actinobacillus, Cardiobacterium, Eikanella, and Kingella. Okay, those are the high yield causes of culture negative endocarditis. And like I mentioned in a previous question, Coxsackie bonaria is Will Felix negative, or can you actually treat with doxycycline? In general, a safe answer for the treatment of tick-borne illnesses is doxycycline. Okay, it's only if the kid is less than 8 years old, then you proceed with amoxicillin, with the exception of what bug? Rickettsia rickettsii. Good. So, the Ixodes tick, I put that as the last question. It carries anaplasmosis. Okay, it carries Babesia microti. Remember the Maltese cross pattern in red cells on Gimsa staining. It actually carries Ehrlichia as well. Okay, it carries Ehrlichia. At least certain species of Ehrlichia. For the most part, on exams, if you see Ehrlichiosis, think of it being carried by the Lone Star tick. Okay. And then it also carries Borrelia burgdorferi, so that's the last B, which, remember, Borrelia burgdorferi is a spirochete. And just as an aside, remember that Ehrlichiosis, right, presents with like headache, fever, thrombocytopenia, so it's kind of similar to Coxsackie bonarii and Rickettsia rickettsii. But the big thing you want to keep in mind is that you do not get a rash, and the white count is usually low with Ehrlichiosis, right? So you get the headache, you get the fever, you get the low platelets, but you also get low white cell counts, and in addition, you generally do not have a rash, unlike Rickettsia rickettsii, where you do get a rash. So next question. 21-year-old female presents with mild vaginal pruritus and what appears to be some vaginal discharge. A vaginal swab is obtained. pH of the obtained secretion is 5.1, with microscopy revealing epithelial cells with bacteria crowded around the edges. Ding, ding, ding. The addition of KOH to this sample, so potassium hydroxide, is accompanied by a fishy smell. Ding, 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 right? So hopefully you're thinking about the bug I'm thinking about in this question. So what is the bug? What is the classic presentation? How do you treat this? Do you need to treat the partner? And I'll give you a bonus for free for your OB-GYN shelf exam in the future. So this is, hopefully you realized from the outset, fishy smell from the vagina. That's bacterial vaginosis, okay? Classically caused by Gardnerella vaginalis, okay? So the classic presentation is a fishy, thin vaginal discharge. Usually the pH is greater than 4.5. of the vaginal secretions. Contrast that with a pH less than 4.5 with candidiasis. Okay. Trichomonas vaginalis is also associated with a vaginal pH greater than 4.5. Although for that, you'll see like the frothy, green, nasty, goopy stuff coming from the vagina. And it you'll see the strawberry cervix, right? So like these punctations on the cervix. Now, the cells I described are clue cells, okay? That's what you see on microscopy. So epithelial cells that are just chock full with a lot of Gardnerella vaginalis. You treat with metronidazole, okay? Remember the get gap on the metro mnemonic for the bugs that can be treated with metronidazole, right? So like Giardia, remember Giardia causes the foul-smelling diarrhea in a patient that drinks from a stream when they go on a hike. There's Entamoeba histolytica. It's one of the protozoal causes of a bloody diarrhea. There's Trichomonas vaginalis. I just talked about that. There is Gardnerella vaginalis that causes bacterial vaginosis. There's anaerobes and there's protozoans. Okay, so get gap on the metro, the bugs that are covered by metronidazole. Now, remember, if you treat with metronidazole and then they describe that this person presents with hypotension and flushing and they feel like crap, like they're hungover, well, hopefully you're thinking about the disulfiram side effect, okay, from metronidazole inhibiting acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, okay? So this is how they can link pharmacology with microbiology and biochemistry very nicely in an exam question, okay? In addition to metronidazole, you could actually potentially give clindamycin for Gardnerella vaginalis. I mean, it works pretty well, but that's not the classic answer on exams. Classically on exams, they go after metronidazole. And remember, if they describe a person that takes clindamycin, right, for bacterial vaginosis, and then they present with a foul-smelling watery diarrhea after they took clinda, okay, hopefully you're thinking about C. diff colitis with that, okay? Now, in general, bacterial vaginosis is not sexually transmitted, so you usually do not need to treat the sexual partner, okay? And the OB-GYN association here is that bacterial vaginosis actually has an association with preterm labor. You'll thank me when you potentially see this on an OB-GYN shelf you will take in the future in your third year, okay? So let's move on to the next question. So STI triggers, these are just statements that should trigger memories of certain common causes of STIs, okay? So the first statement is painless chancre, right? That's T. pallidum, that's syphilis, that's pretty easy. You give penicillin for that, okay? Now, painful genital ulcer with an erythematous base and soft, ragged edges, right? So hopefully with this, you're thinking about Haemophilus ducreyi. Okay, remember, the ulcer in H. ducreyi is painful, right? So Haemophilus ducreyi makes you cry. Okay, that's a very classic mnemonic that is thought. And for H. ducreyi, you can give azithromycin, you can give a ceftriaxone. Okay, remember, ceftriaxone is a third generation cephalosporin. Azithromycin is a 50S inhibitor. It's a marker that inhibits translocation. Next one, painful vesicles, right? So this is not an ulcer. Painful vesicles on an erythematous base, that's HSV, classically HSV2, right? So that's genital herpes. Large intranuclear inclusions on zinc smear, okay? This is also HSV2. Although you can also find that in human herpes virus 3 or VZV, okay? That's why a zinc smear is not very sensitive for herpes simplex virus. Now, school of fish pattern on microscopy. This is also the cause of, this is also the bug that makes you cry. Okay, so it's Haemophilus ducreyi. And then spirochetes detected on dark field microscopy. The spirochete you're thinking about here is Treponema pallidum, right? So the causative agent in syphilis. Painless ulcer, hard base, raised edges with lymphadenopathy. This is again also syphilis caused by Treponema pallidum. And then if you see painless ulcer, and you see this buzzword, very high, like these two buzzwords, very high yield to know those. Beefy red base, irregular edges. Beefy red base, irregular edges. And usually on exams, no lymphadenopathy. This is Klebsiella granulomatis. Okay, so this is the causative agent of granuloma inguinale. And for this, you just give azithromycin. Okay, and you can see like Donovan buddies in white cells when you do microscopy. Okay, so they are usually shaped like bacilli, they're shaped like rods. So again, painless, think about Klebsiella granulomatis causing granuloma inguinale and T. pallidum causing syphilis. Painful vesicles, think more about HSV2. Ulcers, think more about Haemophilus ducreyi, which makes you cry. Okay, next question. Most common cause of UTIs in the US, UTI in a sexually active young female, okay, plus special characteristics of this bug, right? So the most common cause of UTIs in the US is E. coli, causes like 85% of UTIs, okay? Remember, it has like a fimbria that enables it to attach to urinary epithelium. And remember that E. coli is also a part of the normal GI flora. But UTIs, sexually active young female, and you don't see E. coli as an answer choice on exams, go for Staph saprophyticus, okay? Staph saprophyticus is actually the second most common cause of UTIs in the US, okay? And the thing is, classically on exams, you see UTIs and they say, oh, they did a urinalysis, whatever, and it was positive for nitrites, okay? The thing is, Staph saprophyticus is actually nitrite negative, so that can be a very nice clue on exams, okay? So that may be something to tip you more in that direction, because remember, nitrite positivity is usually used to detect the Enterobacteriaceae. Okay, Staph saprophyticus does not belong to that group, so it's nitrite negative. And Staph saprophyticus is also urease positive, okay, just like H. pylori, Klebsiella species, like Klebsiella pneumoniae, there was one other bug, Proteus mirabilis, okay, and Europlasma urolyticum, okay, so it's urease positive, it's catalase positive because it's a Staph species, obviously, okay, but unlike Staph aureus, which is coagulase positive, Staph saprophyticus is coagulase negative, okay, and unlike Staph epidermidis, that is novobiocin sensitive, Staph saprophyticus is novobiocin resistant, okay, so high yield to know those things. Next slide. 76-year-old male presents with a 3-week history of shortness of breath and mild fevers. Physical exam is notable for painful red. Sorry, I made a typo on this slide. I'm just correct it now so I don't forget and post crap when I post the final thing. So physical exam is notable for painful red lesions on the finger pads. Fundoscopic exam reveals bilateral retinal hemorrhage with pale centers. Okay, so painful lesions on the finger pads. I don't know. Are you thinking of something that starts with Osler? Bilateral retinal hemorrhage with pale centers. Are you thinking of something that starts with Roth? Okay. 3 out of 6 murmur is auscultated at the apex. Ding, ding, ding. Okay. So blood cultures here detect gram positive, catalase negative, gamma hemolytic coccus, whose growth is inhibited by 6.5% sodium chloride. Okay. What is the next best step in management? Okay. And then I'll say a few words about enterococcus. So, with this, I hope that I could convince you that this patient has endocarditis, okay? And the bug I'm thinking about here is strep bovis, okay? Strep bovis. If you need to memorize your diagnostic trees, unfortunately, for step one, for the bugs, okay? So if you follow the diagnostic tree that you should have learned from first aid, you should realize that this is strep bovis, okay? It's a kind of group D strep, demonstrates gamma hemolysis, okay? So this is strep bovis, okay? Another closely related bug they may mention on your exam instead of strep bovis is strep galloliticus, okay? So note your parameters here. It's a gram-positive bug, okay? It's a strep species, so it's catalase negative, okay? And because it exhibits gamma hemolysis, it shows no hemolysis on blood agar, okay? And its growth is actually inhibited by 6.5% sodium chloride. Contrast that with the enterococcus species that can grow on 6.5% sodium chloride, okay? This bug, if you ever find it in a person's blood, your next step in management, very classic exam question, is to get a colonoscopy, okay? Because about 30% of patients that have strep bovis bacteremia actually have colon cancer, okay? And the way you treat strep bovis is you can give penicillin or you can give vancomycin. And for the enterococci, which is somewhat closely related strep species, they are gram-positive, they are catalase negative. They also exhibit gamma hemolysis, okay? Although you may read some texts that say, oh, they exhibit variable hemolysis, but that's not really high yield for the exam, okay? But unlike strep bovis, okay, the enterococcus species are actually catalase negative. They actually grow under 6.5% sodium chloride. In fact, they're actually a part of the normal GI flora. And they are usually associated with subacute endocarditis, right? So something that sort of takes weeks to brew over, as against the acute endocarditis you get with Staph aureus that comes on really, really quick, okay? So if you hear about subacute endocarditis after a GI or a GU procedure, think about the enterococcus species, okay? And as an aside, don't forget that vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, right? So enterococcus that vancomycin doesn't work for can be treated with linezolid, okay? With linezolid. Remember, linezolid is your 50S P-site inhibitor, so it basically kills initiation like the aminoglycosides. But remember, the aminoglycosides perform that role from the 30S side of things, okay? Remember, linezolid is bacteriostatic, and it has an association with serotonin syndrome, right? Because it's actually a weak inhibitor of monoamine oxidase. And if they don't give you linezolid as an answer choice for the treatment of VRE, you could also use your streptogramins, okay? Quinupristin, dalfopristin. Remember, these are 50S inhibitors, and they are 50S A-site inhibitors, okay? So they basically shut down the elongation step of protein synthesis. Okay, let's go on to the next question. 30-year-old female presents with a 12-hour history of severe vomiting. She has passed 7 stools in the last 8 hours. Oh no. She visited a Chinese restaurant, ding, 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 last night with a few friends where they had some fried rice. Ding, 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 ding. Okay, so what's the bug? What are its toxins? What's the association? And what are the special bug characteristics, right? So this is a gimme on an NBME exam, okay? This is Bacillus cereus, okay? Be serious, okay? So be serious. Pay attention to this podcast. Just kidding. So Bacillus cereus, okay? This is actually a heat stable. It actually produces 2 kinds of toxins. One toxin is a cerulite toxin that is heat stable, okay? And the thing is, this toxin is actually what causes the severe nausea and vomiting that you get with Bacillus cereus diarrheal infection, okay? So you may ask yourself, why would this be? think about this. If you think about the nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, right, the classic drug used is Zofran, right, ondansetron, which is a serotonin receptor antagonist, okay? The thing is, on the flip side, it so happens that this cerulide toxin that comes from B cereus actually acts as a serotonin receptor agonist, okay? So if you're something that activates serotonin receptors, you actually cause a lot of nausea and vomiting. Contrast that with the drug that's used to treat nausea and vomiting in chemotherapy, okay? Ondansetron, which is a serotonin receptor antagonist, okay? So just something nice to keep in mind. Now, in addition to the heat-stable cerulide toxin, it also has a heat label toxin that actually kind of works like a toxin that I'll mention in a later podcast. But the heat label toxin actually activates adenylate cyclase. Okay, so if you activate adenylate cyclase, you convert more ATP to cyclic AMP, and then you overactivate the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance receptor. Okay, so the CFTR receptor, and by doing that, you release more and more chloride. As that chloride is going to the lumen of the GI tract, as it happily walks along with water. Okay, so you get some kind of secretory diarrhea. Okay, so you get a secretory diarrhea with Bacillus cereus. Okay, the bug is aerobic. Remember, it's a Bacillus species. Bacillus species, they form spores, but they are aerobic. Contrast that with Clostridium species that form spores, but are anaerobic. Okay, so it's an aerobic bug. It forms spores and it is motile. Okay, it is motile. Okay, although Bacillus anthracis also has those similar properties, but B anthracis is actually non-motile. Okay, so something to keep in mind. And again, the classic association on exams, fried rice consumption, Chinese restaurant, watery diarrhea, and a lot of vomiting, that's Bacillus cereus 100% of the time. Okay, next slide. A 30-year-old G1P1 presents to labor and delivery at 39 weeks gestation with regular forceful contractions. She missed her 35-week appointment. It's not a good sign. A quick vaginal smear today reveals gram-positive organisms that exhibit beta hemolysis and are resistant to bacitracin. What is the next best step in the management of this patient? Okay, and then I just put an addendum question at the end. Three-drug cocktail for neonatal meningitis, right? So this is strep A galactiae, okay, group B strep. The next best step in management will actually be to give mom intrapartum penicillin, right? So penicillin before she delivers. Remember that group B strep is catalase negative, okay? It exhibits complete hemolysis on blood agar, right? So it's beta hemolytic. And it's Hippurath and CAMP test positive, okay? It's just one of those weird things you unfortunately need to know for your step one exams, okay? And basically, if you see an exam question that talks about any kind of notable infection in the first month of life, the first 28 days, the neonatal period, your first choice in general on exams should be group B strep, okay? It causes like neonatal meningitis, pneumonia, sepsis. In fact, it's probably the most common cause for all three kinds of those infections. And in general, if a neonate presents with nuchal rigidity, right? So you're thinking about a group B strep. But the thing is, you also have to entertain the idea that E. coli or Listeria could also be causing the meningitis in the neonate, okay? So you cover those neonates with cefotaxime. Cefotaxime is very good at covering group B strep. It can also cover E. coli pretty well, okay? Cefotaxime is a kind of third-generation cephalosporin. We generally prefer that over ceftriaxone in neonates because ceftriaxone can cause cholestasis and cause some biliary problems. So, you give cefotaxime, that's one of the three in the drug cocktail. You give ampicillin. Remember, ampicillin is the drug of choice for the coverage of Listeria. If you don't treat Listeria, meningitis is like 100% fatal. And you also give acyclovir to cover HSV, okay? HSV, again, in a neonate, if it's not treated, it's almost 100% fatal. And the classic way HSV meningitis will present on exams is they show you a lumbar puncture and you see a ton of red cells in the CSF. If you see that, stop reading the question. That's HSV on MBME exams. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. 23-year-old female presents to the ED after having three bouts of bloody diarrhea this morning. She has been having watery diarrhea for the past 3 days. CBC is notable for a hemoglobin of 8.1, that's low, a retic index of 5%, so the person's bone marrow is churning out a ton of red cells. Platelet count is 87,000, that's low. A normal platelet count is greater than 150,000, okay? And the creatinine is 3.1, that's elevated, okay? Schistocytes are visualized on a blood smear. Love this question. So, what's your diagnosis? What's the bug? What's the virulence factor? What's the classic presentation? What are its special properties? And then we'll compare the bug in this Q-stem to a close cousin that also causes a bloody diarrhea. Okay, so hopefully you can recognize the triad here of a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, okay, thrombocytopenia, okay, and the low platelets, okay. So this is hemolytic uremic syndrome. So this can be caused by Shigella, okay, it can also be caused by E. coli 0157H7, okay. So again, triad, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, reticulocytosis telling you the bone marrow is trying to churn out a ton of red cells, schistocytes, which tells you that it's a microangiopathic anemia, okay. Because remember, schistocytes, you get those when you literally shear red cells in the blood vessels. You also get a thrombocytopenia, and then you get an acute renal failure, right? That's why the creatinine is elevated in the question. Okay, so the way this bug almost always presents, and remember, you need like just 10 for Shigella to wreak havoc on your GI tract and cause bloody diarrhea. But in general, this infection usually presents with watery diarrhea for a few days, which then progresses to a bloody diarrhea. Okay, and the virulence factor is actually the Shiga toxin. The Shiga toxin damages the 60S ribosomal subunit in humans. Remember, bacteria have the 50S and 30S ribosomal subunits, but humans, we have the 60S and the 40S ribosomal subunits. So the 60S ribosomal subunit is damaged by the Shiga toxin. And Shigella, you definitely want to remember that it's gram negative. Okay, it's also oxidase negative, and it's a lactose non-fermenter. Okay, so it does not it does not turn pink on McConkie's agar. Okay, and it's non-motile. It's non-motile, doesn't produce hydrogen sulfide when you subject it to a TSI agar. Okay, so contrast this with the close cousin Salmonella. Salmonella also causes a bloody diarrhea, but Salmonella is motile. It produces hydrogen sulfide on TSI agar, right? So these are two characteristics that are not held by Shigella, okay? And just real quick, let me just sort of slow down for a moment here and talk about the oxidase test. You always hear people say, oh, oxidase positive, oxidase negative, oxidase positive, what the oxidase negative? What does that stand for? The thing is, the oxidase test is usually indicative of bacteria that are aerobes, okay? Although remember that being an aerobe does not mean you cannot survive without oxygen, right? You can be a facultative aerobe, or you can be a obligate aerobe. Obligate aerobe, you always need oxygen. Facultative aerobe, you can work with oxygen, but you can also do without oxygen, okay? But being oxidase positive generally means you're an aerobe. Okay, because the test basically detects the ability of the bacteria to secrete, detects the presence of cytochrome C oxidase in the bacteria. And remember that cytochrome C oxidase is actually a part of the electron transport chain. Okay, and you only have an electron transport chain in general if you're using oxygen as a final electron acceptor to produce ATP. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about this. Let's jump on to the next slide. We're almost done. So slide 13, a child of a recent immigrant to the US. If you ever see immigrant in a Q-stem on MBME exams, it's almost always trying to guide you towards something. Okay, so child of a recent immigrant to the US presents with a 7-day history of difficulty breathing. Vaccination records are not available. That's not good. Physical exam is notable for what appears to be small grayish masses in the pharynx. These lesions begin to bleed significantly when poked by the examining medical student. So what's the bug? What's the route of transmission? Classic presentation, special properties, identification, findings with identification. What's the virulence factor? What are the two classically torched organs? We'll talk about preventive strategies and then treatment strategies. Okay, so gray pseudomembrane in the neck, right? So hopefully you're thinking about Corynebacterium diphtheriae. Okay. So C, diphtheria causes diphtheria. This bug is actually transmitted by respiratory droplets. And the classic exam presentation is as a gray pseudomembrane in the back of the throat, usually in the pharynx, that bleeds easily when you scrape that. So that's more of a step two clue that they provide. Okay. And you can also say something like bull's neck. Okay. The bull's neck just comes from having a ton of your cervical lymph nodes severely enlarged. Okay. And this bug is gram positive. It's an aerobe. Okay. It's a gram positive aerobic rot. And it does not move. Okay. I sort of think of C. diphtheria as a mafia boss. Doesn't go on actual like bad stuff, but he sends out his people to go and do the killings or taking money from people. That's the way C. diphtheria works. Okay. It doesn't move anywhere. It just stays in your airway. Okay. But it shoots out toxin that's encoded by bacteriophages. Very high yield to know that. The toxin is bacteriophage encoded. Okay. So it sends out its toxin. Okay. To do its dirty deeds. And the toxin does a lot of bad stuff that I'll talk about shortly. But other things you want to know with regards to identification is that C. diphtheria grows on Telluride agar. Okay, so it grows as like black colonies on Telluride agar. And there is actually a test where you basically perform an assay where you try to observe toxin-antitoxin interactions. You can actually use that test to detect the toxin. Okay, it's known as the ELEK test, E-L-E-K, the ELEK test. And unlike microscopy, if you actually look up a picture of this, it's actually pretty striking. C. diphtheria actually looks like Chinese letters. Now, the virulence factor is the diphtheria toxin. That's easy to remember. And the way the toxin works is that it causes ADP ribosylation of elongation factor 2. Okay, ADP ribosylation of elongation factor 2. Okay, remember elongation factor 2 is actually involved in translocation of stuff along the ribosome, right? So helping you go, for example, from the A site of the ribosome to the P site of the ribosome. Okay, if you ADP ribosylate elongation factor 2, then elongation factor 2 doesn't work anymore. Okay, so because you basically killed protein synthesis, that is how you get many of the badness with C. diphtheria infection. Okay, so this toxin, again, remember it's encoded by a bacteriophage, so by a virus that infects bacteria. And as an aside, remember that it is not only the diphtheria toxin that causes ADP ribosylation of elongation factor 2. This is also done by exotoxin A that we get with our friend Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Okay. In fact, the MBME, they could actually tie this to a pharmacology question by just asking about drugs that could produce a cellular effect that's similar to the action of this ADP ribosylating toxin, right? So like preventing translocation, if you may. So drugs you want to think about are like your 50S inhibitors, like clindamycin and your macrolides. Okay, those are prime target exam questions. And the organs that are classically torched by C. diphtheria, especially the toxin, is your heart, right? So you can get a myocarditis, you can get a heart block, and also your brain and your like nerves, okay? Those are the things that are classically engaged by the toxin of Corynebacterium diphtheria. Now, how do you prevent this infection, right? Well, don't be an anti-vaxxer. That's usually like a not smart thing to do to yourself or your kids, okay? But you prevent it by giving the DTaP or the Tdap vaccine. They are pretty much the same. It's just like the age ranges of when you give what that is sort of different, okay? And the treatment of C. diphtheria is with the macrolide erythromycin, okay? You could also use penicillin, but I'll say in general for MBM is the big thing you want to know is erythromycin or any other macrolide. And if a person has active disease, right, you can try to give antitoxin to bind up whatever toxin that has not wreaked havoc on the person's brain and heart. Okay, next question. Common blood culture contaminant, common cause of prosthetic valve endocarditis. This bug is gram-positive, catalase-positive, and coagulase-negative. Okay, so catalase-positive, gram-positive. I really hope you're thinking of some kind of staph species. Okay, so what's the bug, and why does this bug have such an easy time attaching to prosthetic valves, and how do you treat this? Okay, so this bug is staph epidermidis. Okay. Remember that it is novobiocin sensitive, unlike Staph saprophyticus, that causes UTIs and is novobiocin resistant. Okay. It has all the characteristics I mentioned in the slide, right? So it's like gram positive, it's catalase positive, it's coagulase negative. Remember, the high yield Staph species that's coagulase positive is Staph aureus. Okay. So this bug is novobiocin. It's novobiocin sensitive. Okay. And the reason it has such an easy time attaching to prosthetic valves is that it makes biofilm. Okay. And the way you actually treat Staph epidermidis is classically you give vancomycin. Okay. Or you can give any other kind of anti-staphylococcal penicillin. Okay. Final slide. 45-year-old male presents with high fevers, shortness of breath, and diarrhea. He recently returned from a business conference, at the Unique Hotel, which is known for having an indoor waterfall. Ding, 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 ding. CMP is notable for a sodium of 123. Ding, 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 ding. So what's the bug? What are its special characteristics? How is this stained? How do you ID this bug? How do you test for this bug? How does it classically present and how do you treat this? Okay, so this is Legionella, right? So Legionnaire's disease. Okay, remember Legionella pneumophila is a gram-negative rod. It actually has some unusual branching fatty acids in the cell wall, so it doesn't stain very well. Okay, and the thing is, it stains positive with silver. And real quick, as an aside, what is the bug that also causes like serious-ish respiratory infections in AIDS patients? That also stains positive with silver. Well, I hope you're saying Pneumocystis jervetzi. Okay. Now, back to Legionella, right? So Legionella pneumophila, it actually grows on charcoal yeast extract that you enrich with iron and cysteine. It's just something they love to test. You definitely want to commit that to memory. And the way you diagnose this bug is by doing a urinary antigen test. Okay. It's called the Legionella urine antigen test, like the LUAT, if you may. And the classic presentation on exams is in relation to business conferences, okay? And they almost always mention some kind of thing with like a waterfall or central air conditioning. That's the way they love to present this. And another presentation is as I think of Legionella as like pneumonia plus, okay? So pneumonia plus like other bad stuff like diarrhea or hyponatremia, which is a relatively specific finding in Legionella pneumophila. Okay, and it can also present with other weird stuff, but I really want you to think of diarrhea and hyponatremia. Okay, and the way you treat Legionella, like every other cause of atypical pneumonia, is with a macrolide. Okay, with a macrolide, and actually, this macrolide mnemonic may help you remember how you treat the three. I guess help you remember like how you treat and the three common causes of atypical pneumonia. Right. So just spell out the word macrolide. And capitalize the letter M, the letter C, and the letter L, okay? This was actually thought to me by a person I tutored back in the day. So I'll give the person credit right now. So the M stands for mycoplasma, okay? The capitalized C stands for chlamydia, and the capitalized L stands for Legionella, okay? So these are the three bugs that are covered by macrolides. And these three bugs are all causes of atypical pneumonia, although the most common one is mycoplasma. Okay, so that's the end of this podcast. If you have any questions or spot any errors, please don't be afraid to send out an email or try to put a comment in the comment section below the podcast. And I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. We'll definitely have some more podcasts on bacteria coming up. Have a good night and God bless you.